hiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, go ahead and have a seat. Welcome to the first case of this term. It's nice to see all of you. And we are ready for some exciting work. 20 AP 2003, Wisconsin Justice Initiative, Inc. versus Wisconsin Elections Commission. Could I please have your appearances? Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Attorney Dennis Kuczynski. I'm here representing the plaintiff respondents, Wisconsin Justice Initiative, Jacqueline Boynton, Jerome F. Beauty, Craig Wisconsin, and
good morning. All right, the lineup that I have is 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes, and a rebuttal of 5 minutes, correct? Good. It's always good to have that sorted out first. All right, please proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Article 12, Section 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution states that it shall be the duty of the legislature to submit proposed constitutional amendments to the people in such manner as the legislature shall prescribe, provided that if more than one amendment be submitted, they shall be submitted separately so the people may vote yes or no separately. Because our Constitution entrusts our legislature with this broad authority and discretion, judicial review of the legislature's exercises of its broad authority and discretion must be necessarily limited to whether the legislature at base violated its constitutional duty. I plan to focus on two main points today. First, I'd like to further show just how simple and limited judicial review of the legislature's chosen phrasing of a ballot question must be. Second, I'd like to further confront the misplaced misconception that this amendment deprived Wisconsin criminal defendants of state constitutional rights. So turning to the framework for courts, the entire analysis when courts are presented with a challenge to the legislature's chosen phrasing of a ballot question for a proposed constitutional amendment must be limited to three narrow questions. First, did the ballot question communicate the amendment's essential purpose? Second, did the ballot question instead present an entirely different question than the amendment? And third, are there provisions of the amendment that do not tend to affect or carry out the amendment's essential purpose? That's it. And so if we have a yes, a no, and a no, that's the end of the inquiry for court. And that has to be the end of the judicial inquiry, because any broader questioning or standard would allow the judiciary to second-guess discretionary decisions that our Constitution entrusts to our legislature.
I hear you saying setting forward the constitutional standard. Do you also agree that the legislature has set forth a standard under 5.64 and that it also needs to meet that because that's what the legislature said? And as a court, we should hold the legislature to the words that they've stated in by statute. Would you agree with that as well?
I would agree that in 5.64 2AM, the legislature has prescribed what it requires of itself in the ballot question. I would agree with that, but ultimately in terms of judicial review, the court's questioning, the question for courts has to be focused on whether the legislature violated those standards.
There's no challenge to the compliance with that statute in this case, is there?
There's no separate challenge to that independent from the constitutional violations.
Is that because, and this is maybe a question for your opposing counsel, but is that because the statute is, following what the Constitution says in terms of prescribing by law how you're supposed to do it? And let me just back up for a little bit, because We have some arguments about the every essential element test. You've got a constitutional text. You've got a statute enacted pursuant to the constitutional text. That's where my mind goes. What's the law we're focused on? Are we focused on something else besides Article 12, Section 1 and 5.64?
No, Your Honor. Your Honor is correct that okay. those have to be the focuses. And so what those three questions I just articulated are using this court's prior interpretations of those of the constitutional text and the relevant statute to prescribe the necessarily limited scope of judicial review.
Other than the separate amendment challenge, putting that aside for a moment, I want to ask you about this every essential element test. And you proposed, the way I read your brief, and feel free to correct me, is not doing too much more than 5.64 does and requiring sort of a concise and reasonably accurate, you know, summary, I guess. You know, the statute says a concise summary. But I'm trying to figure out where that comes from. I mean, I obviously, you know, read the language in Eckern, and but we've never applied it. I don't see it anywhere in the text. And so of the actual Constitution. And so I'm trying to figure out what to do with it. We have an invitation to make sense of some things we've said in dicta and past decisions that we've never actually applied, never used to hold or decide a case. And so I'm trying to figure out, outside of the statute, which sort of implements the constitutional text, what we're supposed to do with that.
And I understand Your Honor's questions, and I understand Your Honor's concern. And so we believe that this court can, using the groundwork that's already established through Eckern and subsequent cases, provide the clarity that recognizes that under Article 12, Section 1, the legislature's constitutional duty is to present the amendment to the voters. And so what we read Eckern to say is that if the ballot question does not communicate the essential purpose of that amendment, then that could be a situation where the legislature has, in essence, failed to present the question to voters. Now, we haven't asked this court to overturn those prior decisions, and I would note that this court has, in other instances, recognized McConkie as one example, that while there are while the legislature's discretion has to be broad, there are potentially outer limits. So we're not asking this court to overturn any of its prior decisions, but I think Your Honor is right that we have to go to the constitutional language of Article 12, Section 1, and that gives the legislature extremely broad authority and discretion. And so that's why we propose that this court should read Eckern's Every Essential to require only that the ballot question communicate the amendment's essential purpose. Because if it requires anything further than the essential purpose of that amendment, that is intruding into the discretion that our Constitution entrusts our legislature to exercise about what other components of the amendment may be included. Because, of course, the legislature, in exercising its constitutional authority, can decide that there are other components of the amendment that it may want to include, but that's a decision for the legislature.
Attorney Jurors, go ahead. This test from Eckern, Every Essential, seems to have just been made up by the court. As Justice Hagedorn pointed out, it's not grounded in the constitutional text. Is there any good reason why this court should continue to perpetuate a test that is arguably inconsistent with the constitutional text? Because I traced back the history of early ballot questions, and interestingly, they didn't come close to containing every essential element or aspect of a ballot question. Sometimes they were worded as simply as for the amendment or against the amendment. So could you speak to that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree that Your Honor, that the analysis for judicial review has to be grounded in the constitutional text. We have not asked this court to overturn its prior decisions, but I think this court could fairly look at its language in Eckern and question whether that language was even limited to the ballot question alone, because, of course, we know the ballot question is only one part of the submission to voters, that even in 1925, when this court decided Eckern, There were notices that provide the text of the constitutional amendment, and so the ballot question was one piece of it. And I think the Court of Appeals recognized that questioning about was Eckern really talking just about the ballot question or the submission more broadly in its MMAC case. But I think to go back to the way the court could harmonize Eckern without overturning it, if the court decides it does not wish to do so, is to recognize that when this court in Eckern said every essential, what it means is, was the essential purpose of the amendment communicated? And Eckern does talk about, was the real purpose of the amendment submitted to voters?
Please finish.
Oh, no. Go ahead, Justice Bradley.
Thank you. The language in Eckern, I think, that we are focusing on is that the form is prescribed by the legislature. It must reasonably, intelligently, and fairly comprise or have reference to every essential of the amendment. That's the language of Eckert that we've been focusing on, every essential of the amendment as the test, or arguably the test. Are you asking that Eckern be overturned, overruled?
No, we haven't asked for that. What we're asking is that this court interpret that language to mean that
every essential purpose is what you're asking
for. Has the essential purpose of the amendment been communicated?
Yes, and I think you rely on a Minnesota Supreme Court case, if I remember correctly on that. Is the language every essential purpose rooted in the constitutional language?
I think essential purpose is rooted in the Constitution.
Okay, show me where that is.
Well, the actual word purpose is not found in the Constitution.
That's exactly my point. So it's not rooted in the Constitution. Your test, if there can be some angst raised that the test as set forth in Eckern is not rooted in the constitutional text, it seems to me fair that angst also applies to the test that you propose. Am I correct or incorrect?
I would respectfully disagree, and the reason I would disagree is that our proposed test is informed and entirely shaped by the fact that the Constitution entrusts the legislature with the authority and discretion to decide how it wants to submit this to proposed amendments to voters. So, if we move anywhere broader than essential purpose, has the amendment been presented, the essential purpose of the amendment been presented to voters, then we're intruding into discretionary choices. And so use this case as an example. WJI has presented a laundry list of components of the Marcy's Law Amendment that it says should have been included in the ballot question but weren't. But notably, they aren't arguing that every component of the amendment needed to be included. So why the ones that they've said need to be included and not others? And if we don't keep this test extremely narrow, then what's to prevent other parties from saying, well, actually, I think this component of the amendment should have been communicated in the ballot question or that component?
Is it proper for this court to weigh the discretionary choices of the legislature? Isn't that really a political question?
It is absolutely a political question. And that's why this court's the framework for judicial review has to be extremely narrow in this circumstance.
Does your brief use the words political question?
I don't remember off the top of my head whether our brief uses that, but what I will say is we can look at the case law that we cite, and as Your Honor noted, we point to the League of Wisconsin Voters Minnesota Supreme Court case.
Yes.
And that court recognized that, and I'll just read a passage from that. We acknowledge that the ballot question as framed by the legislature does not use the same words used in the amendment itself, nor does it list all of the potential effects of the proposed amendment. These failures may be criticized, and it may indeed have been wiser for the legislature to include the entire amendment on the ballot. The proper role for the judiciary, however, is not to second-guess the wisdom of policy decisions that the Constitution commits to one of the political branches.
And I understand that you've referenced that. My concern is this. I may have missed it, but I did not see any words in your brief that dealt said political question. So I did not take you to be advancing the argument of it's a political question, since you did not use those words. Now, we probably have some clerk someplace looking up quickly whether or not those words are in. And I'm not doing that at the moment. But that's my recollection. It was not referenced. And so are you making that argument? You didn't make the argument in the brief, as I saw it, that this is a political question.
Well, I do know for sure that we very much stressed that the Constitution entrusts this decision to the legislature, and it's a legislative exercise of its discretion. So I think we absolutely did focus on that, and I think that's the very point.
Okay. So you argued it's a political question without using those words, and used instead the words of, I don't want to say acquiescence, but generally acquiescence to the legislative choice.
Yes, Your Honor, if I'm understanding your question correctly, that we've stressed, because that's what Article 12, Section 1 provides, that this is the phrasing of this question, the content of this question, that belongs to the legislature, so judicial review has to be extremely narrow, because otherwise we're moving beyond did the legislature violate its constitutional duty, and into would we have made different choices as the judiciary?
One final comment. There's a difference between political question doctrine and that it's extremely limited. Certainly our court, in a couple of cases, have reviewed this, Eckhorn and McConkie, it seems to me that your argument isn't political question, but rather very limited. Tell me if I'm wrong on that.
Our argument is that based on this court's prior case law, there are three narrow questions that courts must be limited to asking when reviewing challenges to a ballot question. And going back to that first question, because I think that's where the most clarity from this court is needed, did the ballot question communicate the amendment's essential purpose? In good news, this court has already explained how courts discern an amendment's essential purpose. This court did so in McConkie, which was a separate amendment case. And in perhaps even better news, as this court explained in McConkie, figuring out an amendment's essential purpose is not an interpretive riddle. You look at the text, and that's generally going to tell you what the essential purpose is. If there's any doubt, you look at the historical context in which the amendment was ratified.
Attorney Juris, can I ask you I'm going to pivot here, as much as you probably want to continue down this line.
I'm happy to go wherever you'd like.
Okay. I'm looking at the ACLU brief, and my question is more the substance of what is actually in the amendment. And the ACLU brings up they have four main concerns as I read their brief. And the first one is that one of the issues is that the new amendment, Marcy's Law, limits discovery available to defendants because victims no longer have to submit to, or they're allowed to refuse an interview, a deposition, or a discovery request. So that's the first one. The second one is that they're concerned because victims have the right to attend all proceedings and the unless sequestration is necessary to a fair trial for the defendant has been. If you're taking notes, I'll talk slower. And you're lucky Justice Hagedorn isn't talking right now because he talks really fast and it's hard to write as fast as he can. The third is that it removes from the Wisconsin Constitution a guarantee that nothing in this section or in any statute enacted pursuant to this section shall limit any right of the accused which may be provided by law, right? It's that it says, just it moved it to. And the last is the concern about the no less vigorous language. And so I wanted to give you an opportunity to address each of those before, if you would. They also come up in your opponent's brief, but I thought they were summarized nicely in the ACLU brief, and I'm wondering what your response is to all four of those.
Yes, Your Honor. So I'm going to start big picture, and then I'll take each point in turn. So what's critical is that the ballot question does not have to contain every effect, every detail of a proposed amendment. That is nowhere to be found in Wisconsin law, and then that runs, as I've been arguing, the risk of judicial second-guessing or editing of the legislature's discretionary decisions. It's also critical to keep in mind that even if there were, which I can explain further, but even if there were potential effects of this amendment on state constitutional rights of defendant, even if that were correct, which it's not, the effects and even the constitutional effects of an amendment are not proper subject of a ballot question challenge. This Court said that in Milwaukee Alliance at page 602, when a ballot question is challenged, what is not at issue is the wisdom or constitutionality of the amendment. And that makes complete sense, because essentially what WJI is asking is that the legislature is required to, in crafting a ballot question, anticipate every possible argument, including constitutional arguments and potentially decades of this Court's litigation, anticipate all of that, anticipate it correctly, and somehow input all of that into a concise ballot question. So just wanted to start there. Now, turning to the different points, I guess one last overarching point is that Article 1, Section 9M, has never been, ever, an affirmative source of state constitutional rights for criminal defendants. It did not exist until 1993. And then when it was created, a defendant could not have pointed to Article 1, Section 9M as a source of his rights. A defendant could not have argued my right to a fair trial was violated because a judge didn't read a proper instruction, for example, under Article 1, Section 9M. A defendant could not have even pointed to Article 1, Section 9M to say my right to a fair trial was violated because the victim wasn't sequestered, because the source of what is or is not a fair trial for a defendant has never been 9M. There are, and another overarching point is that there are no instances where the Wisconsin state constitution provides greater protections to criminal defendants specifically than the federal constitution in a way that could come into conflict with victims' rights.
Do we have to say that, though? I get a little concerned about saying too much. Even if you're right, even if we agree with you, do we have to go so far as saying Section 9M didn't do anything and there's never going to be any conflict? I saw that in some of the amicus briefing as well, and I get concerned about saying too much. Even if we bought your premise,
Your Honor, the court doesn't have to say it for the reason that this court explained in Milwaukee Alliance, which is that the constitutionality and potential constitutional effects or general effects of the amendment are not at issue in a ballot question challenge. So in terms of coming back to those points, all proceedings, so I have discovery, all proceedings, any right, and no less vigorous. In terms of discovery, they have not identified, there are no state constitutional discovery rights that provide greater protection for defendants than federal constitutional rights. It is Eason, which is the good faith exception to the suppression rule. It is Jarrell CJ, which is juvenile interrogations, and it is NAP, which are deliberate Miranda violations. And in terms of what this amendment did, the ballot question told voters what this amendment did. It told voters that victims would be getting more rights, that the strength of protection of those rights would be coming from below that of defendants, up to that level, with the new backstop being defendants' federal constitutional rights. They don't like how that was phrased, but that communicated the information about what that new backstop would be. In terms of all proceedings, we've been asking for years to identify examples of how this has actually violated defendants' rights. And the fact that after years of this litigation and this being the constitutional law of Wisconsin, they still cannot identify any meaningful examples of how this is violating defendants' rights, I think further shows the danger of undermining the legislature's exercise of its discretion based on concerns about potential effects that may or may not prove true. And then I think I've addressed the any right of federal constitutional third point, so I'll turn lastly to the no less vigorous language. And this really goes to the second question under the standard. Did the ballot question present an entirely different question than the amendment? The answer is absolutely not. The legislature gets to make phrasing choices, and the only instance in Wisconsin history where this court has ever invalidated an amendment because of a ballot question was in Thompson, where it was entirely different. It was the exact opposite. The ballot question told voters that the amendment would do the exact opposite of what the amendment actually would do.
What was the reason when this ballot was proposed for not specifically stating that the sequestration of the victim was changed?
What was the reason that wasn't specifically addressed in the ballot question?
Right.
So that's not directly addressed in the drafting file, I can tell Your Honor that, but what I will say is the ballot question told voters that victims would be getting more rights, that the strength of protection would be coming up, and what that new backstop would be on victims' rights insofar as they could come into tension with defendants' rights. So I would say that the ballot question did communicate the necessary information.
If I read it, I wouldn't have any idea about the fact that sequestration was affected by the ballot question.
So if I may, I see my red light is on.
Yeah.
May I answer your question?
Thank you.
Thank you. So, as I said, the ballot question did communicate the new backstop, but even beyond that, we have to keep in mind that this ballot question is just designed to be the light bulb that says, ah, this is what I'm voting on. It is not the only or even close to only source of information for the voters, and so that exact change was provided in the Type C notice and through other publicly accessible information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Before addressing the four grounds on which the 2020 ballot question failed to validly present the proposed amendments for ratification by the voters, I'd like to address a few recent comments and what's at stake in this case. Our Constitution gives the legislature and the voters the constitutional roles in amending the Constitution. The legislature has incredibly broad discretion in proposing changes. But as the Eckern and Thompson courts recognized, it then becomes up to the voters to exercise their sacred responsibility, opportunity to say yea or nay. The whole purpose of both the separate amendment test and of the essential elements test, and of the pronouncements in each of the cases, is that if there's more than one sort of big issue, separate subject, separate purposes, you need more than one amendment. That makes perfect sense. Also, you know, the statute says summary. Summary is more than the essential purpose of this is blank. That's sort of a title, a chapter heading. Summary says, here's what you're being asked to approve. Eckern and Thompson recognized that the essential elements test is to make sure that the voters are intelligently and comprehensively informed of what it is they're voting on.
But it doesn't say, it doesn't,
Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. It doesn't say comprehensively, though, right? I mean, Eckern says even if the form, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley just stated this earlier, even if the form is prescribed by the legislature, it must reasonably, intelligently, and fairly comprise or have reference to every essential of the amendment. It doesn't say comprehensive.
You're correct. I'm sorry. But it needs to ensure that they're fully informed to make an intelligible decision.
But the voters do have a responsibility, right, to research what the ballot question is all about, no different than when they are voting on candidates. They have a responsibility to be aware of what the candidates' positions are and what they're voting on. There's no requirement in the Constitution or the statutes for the ballot to list the platform of candidates, and there's no requirement in the Constitution or the statutes that everything in a constitutional amendment be conveyed on the ballot.
That's correct. The notice, as defendants' counsel acknowledged, only notice that's published in connection with an amendment to the Constitution is the Type C notice. That was not published until very shortly before the election in this case, spring of 2020. It's like the Monday and the week before the election. Approximately three quarters of the voters in that spring election voted early voting or absentee voting. A very large number of them voted before that notice was published at all. Otherwise, there was a notice that went out early in the process that said, here's an amendment coming. You can find the text online. Lots of people in this state don't have internet access or certainly not broadband access. I think the purpose and approach to informing the voters simply was not accomplished or satisfied.
Is it your position that because of the pandemic and because of what went on around the April 7th, 2020 election, that had this language been used during another election where there wasn't a pandemic, it would be okay?
I don't say that it would have been okay. I'm simply saying that the notice here, the ability of the voters to be informed or easily or readily informed, was even less here than in other elections.
But we're sort of guessing, right? Like, we don't know who was informed. We don't know who read a Type C notice and who didn't. I mean, people may have had more time on their hands because it was the pandemic and they were stuck at home looking at their dogs.
That's possible.
Could you explain, please, the relationship of the statute to your claims? I understand the sort of, you know, broader arguments about, you know, people knowing and not knowing, but I really care about the sources of the law upon which we're to base our decision. And I see two. I see a constitutional text, Article 12, Section 1, and I see a statute enacted pursuant to the constitutional text. And I'd like to understand what you think 5.64 has to do with your claim and how you see the relationship between those.
I think it requires something more than identifying simply the essential subject as defense counsel has proposed.
So do you see the every essential element test language in Eckern as rooted in the statute?
I think it's rooted both in the statute and in the fact that the Constitution gives a constitutional role to the voters.
It does, but as Justice Rebecca Bradley pointed out, the early ballot questions submitted to voters were largely in the nature of for the amendment or against the amendment for decades and decades. That was actually the practice until the statute was enacted requiring a little bit more language. The statute was futzed with and amended a little bit when it first was enacted hundred and some years ago. But early on, there seems to be very little that I can tell from the original meaning of the Constitution that suggested that the constitutional language itself requires much of anything in the way of a description. And that largely what we are arguing about is what the concise summary in the current statute requires.
Well, whether it's by nature of the role of the voters and the need of the voters to be informed about what they're voting in, or whether it's the language in the statute requiring a concise summary, for approximately 100 years, this court has recognized that in order for the voters to have the information that they need, the ballot question needs to be accurate, it needs to be not misleading or ambiguous, and it needs to inform the voters, as the court has put it, of every essential element, and describing the purpose of that as being providing enough information so that the voters can intelligently vote.
I'd just like to, I guess, reiterate that, you know, if that idea is supposed to be rooted in the constitutional text, then nearly every amendment to our Constitution for the first several decades was enacted in violation of the Constitution.
Well, we're here now, and for 100 years, this court has said that's what our Constitution requires.
The problem that I have, as I mentioned in my question to the state, is that it seems like this court is required by our own pronouncement in Eckern to delve into policy choices and policy making, because what I think the essential purpose of this quite lengthy amendment was maybe different than what Justice Rogensack thinks. She asked a question of the state related to, well, why wasn't this aspect of the amendment? And to me, that's not a justiciable question, because it's bringing in our subjective views of what is essential to the law, which would then displace what the legislature deemed appropriate for the wording of the question. And it seems to me that that would allow this court to intrude into the legislature's prerogative and, as you, I believe, described it, very broad discretion to phrase the question.
Very broad discretion to phrase the amendment, and discretion to phrase the question limited by the need of the and purpose of the question to intelligently inform the voters. Let me explain. No one is claiming that the language in the 1993 amendment that protected rights of the accused created new state constitutional rights for the accused, though defendants and some amici have claimed that it's the position of the plaintiffs and was the position of the trial court. Rather, the 1993 amendments and the legislative drafting notes demonstrate that the legislature's intent and understanding was that including those words, both protecting the sequestration right and the more general conclusion of 9M, protecting victims' rights without limiting any legal rights of the accused, was that including those words would protect the existing state constitutional and statutory rights of the accused from being repealed, overridden, or limited by the new victims' rights amendments. Just looking at the words, textual analysis demonstrates that's what those words did. They assured that increasing victims' rights was not repealing, overriding, or diminishing any state rights of defendants, of the accused. And the 1993 ballot question accurately informed voters that victims' rights would be protected, as the question said, quote, without limiting any legal rights of the accused. These amendments took those words out of our Constitution. They changed our Constitution. They didn't go back and strike words from the accused rights in the Constitution, but they struck the words that prevented the expansion of victims' rights in 1993 from repealing those rights.
But you're not suggesting that the removal of language from the Wisconsin Constitution would in any way affect the rights of defendants protected under the United States Constitution. That can't be, right?
No, they couldn't be. But that's why our state constitution is important. It's an independent source of rights.
But the victims' rights the victims' rights amendment, as it was previously worded, was not a source of rights for defendants. So the removal of language referencing the rights of defendants could not impede the rights of defendants or impair them.
Oh, yes, it could. The 1993 amendments increased victims' rights. The words that were included at the time said, we're doing this, but doing this, these rights are not allowed to override or repeal existing rights of the defendants in state law or constitution. Those words had some meaning.
What was the meaning? Because what rights did this... What rights did the state constitution give to defendants that they no longer have under the federal constitution?
I'm not saying they changed rights under the federal constitution, but they changed rights, removing those words, changed rights of defendants under state constitution.
But that's what I'm asking you. What right does a criminal defendant no longer have by virtue of the removal of those words from the state constitution?
They can't look to the state constitution or laws to override what are described in some cases as absolute rights of victims.
But which rights? Are you asking about
specific? One is the sequestration.
Let's talk about that. That would be great. The state says that, and I can't find it either, and I got to tell you, I spent years and years and years prosecuting cases where sensitive cases where victims were involved. I spent years and years and years as the head of the Office of Crime Victim Services helping victims get the services that they needed around the state. I have not, in my experience, nor have I read a case, nor have I seen a case since this started that talks about any, let me get the word that the state used in their argument. I cannot find any meaningful example of a case where a defendant's rights were violated because a victim was forced to leave a courtroom where his or her case was the whole reason for the court hearing in the first place. Is there any case that you can cite me? Is there any example that you can cite me? I do not understand this at all. I don't understand why you can't have the victim testify first. I don't understand why, if the victim doesn't testify first, that the defense can't cross-examine the victim on the fact that he or she didn't testify first. I don't know why, if all of that happens, the defense can't then argue that in closing argument. I just do not see this. This feels like a straw man argument to me.
Let me explain. Looking to the federal constitution as the source of defendants' rights is relying on rights that can be changed by the decision of as few as five justices of the U.S. Supreme Court with no vote or role for our voters. Any of the defendants' federal constitutional rights which were expanded over decades and be decreased today or moving forward. That's why independent state rights are of importance. They can't be changed without action, both by the legislature and by ratification of our voters.
I think you're suggesting that the United States Supreme Court has a power it does not have, which is to override the text and original meaning of the Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court can't remove rights that are grounded in the Constitution.
I would simply say that we've seen rights increase and we've seen rights decrease. And the fact that rights may currently be protected is not a guarantee that they will be protected moving forward.
Counsel, I want to put aside the separate amendment question for the moment. Assume for the moment that that provision of the Constitution was complied with, okay? Could you please give us an example of how you think the legislature, at some minimal level, should have and could have worded this question in order to comply with your version of the proper test?
Certainly. About adding about 30 words to the ballot question in places in the question itself, which is reasonably short, but simply adding, quote, to expand the definition of victim, to remove language preventing victims' rights from limiting state legal rights of the accused, and to provide victims with non-party rights to state Supreme Court review. Adding those words to the question would at least have covered what we believe are the essential elements. That sets aside the question of the difference between with equal force and no less vigorously than, which we explain in our brief in detail, simply can't be reconciled. They do not mean the same thing. It's the problem that was described here as a completely different question. It doesn't require protection with equal force. It requires something different. That means it's a completely different question.
Counsel, I have another question that wasn't really talked about, but I'm curious about why this wasn't challenged after the second ratification by the legislature, or passing by the legislature, which was a year before it was then on the ballot. Is there a reason why you're now challenging a ballot question that has now been passed by the voters, as opposed to doing it during that interim time period?
The Wisconsin Justice Initiative is a small nonprofit with modest resources. Among other things, finding an attorney to represent them pro bono takes time.
Do you think it matters, though, in terms of our analysis, or no?
I don't think
the
it way
matters. We analyze it the same.
We went and challenged, the Wisconsin Justice Initiative and the other plaintiffs challenged the question significantly before the election, before the ballots were to be printed, sought a temporary injunction, did everything they could have done, and the trial court said, I'm not going to keep the ballots from being printed. We can address this after the election.
Okay. Thank you.
The case here really is not a victim's rights case. It's not a rights of the accused case. It's about the integrity of the process of amending our state constitution. To uphold the ballot question here, as defendants urge, this court would have to decide that the question did not need to inform voters that the language protecting state constitutional and statutory rights of the accused from being repealed or overridden by victims' rights was being removed from our constitution. It seems to me deciding that would mean deciding either that the words that the legislature and voters included in the 1993 amendments protecting defendants' rights were mere surplusage and meaningless. That's contrary to the rules of statutory and constitutional construction. Or that protections of rights of the accused in our Constitution are mere surplusage and can be disposed of without informing the voters because the U.S. Constitution may provide similar rights. Either approach denigrates our state constitution, finding either that words in it don't matter or that its role as an independent source of rights doesn't matter. Again, the legislature proposes, but it's the voters who decide.
Counsel, you have referenced with regard to the prior constitutional provision of Article 1, Section 9, that language that is as follows: the opportunity to attend court proceedings unless the trial court finds sequestration is necessary to a fair trial for the defendant. I have not heard in your argument here today reference to the last sentence of the prior constitutional provision. And I will read it, but I emphasize the word any rights. That prior constitutional provision stated, nothing in this section or in any statute enacted pursuant to this section shall limit any right of the accused which shall be provided by law. Of course, the new amendment makes reference only to limiting federal constitutional rights. What import, if any, is the difference of this wording?
It's incredibly important, and you know, our briefs laid out that in with great emphasis. That those words were removed, and instead, language misdirecting the voters about essentially saying federal rights of the accused are not changed in any way. It sort of elides the fact, obscures the fact, covers up perhaps the fact that important language protecting defendants' rights, essentially saying victims' rights can go this far and no further under our state laws, is gone. I mean, that's huge, but not mentioned. And that's why, in addition to the difference between with equal force and no less vigorously than, which means either equally vigorously or more vigorously.
Wouldn't that later be an as-applied constitutional challenge to a particular defendant's rights that were violated because of this provision?
It could be, but here we're asking and deciding, you are deciding, we're asking, you're deciding whether this amendment was validly ratified. That's a question of compare the amendment to what the ballot question says. If there's something in the ballot question that is not accurate, that is not true, this court has said over and over again, it's a different question and it's not validly ratified.
But what's not true in the question? What's inaccurate?
The ballot question refers to protecting victims' rights with equal force to the protection of defendants' rights, rights of the accused. And actually, the amendments call for protecting victims' rights no less vigorously than. Whatever no less than means,
Give us a practical example of a defendant's rights under the state constitution being violated because of this provision. A real-life practical consequence that will happen because of this provision. My colleagues kind of all been asking that same question.
I would look to State v. Green, cited earlier this year, last term, by this court, in which this court cited the new constitutional rights, that's these amendments, of victims in altering the balance and essentially doing away with the automatic stay of a medication order when an accused, while presumed innocent, is determined to be incompetent. And
So that will be violated because of this provision, the medication stay?
Yes. Previously, it was recognized that the right of the incompetent defendant to the ability to have an appeal and temporarily stay the medication order on that kind of a medication order was protecting the fundamental liberty interest of not being involuntarily medicated. This amendment, the amendment we're talking about here, was cited by this court in changing that balance, and doing away with the automatic right to
Green
a stay.
Well, Green was decided based on pretrial medication, where you can never try someone in Wisconsin if they're incompetent, and without giving them medication, the doctor had testified that they could never have a trial with this person who had admittedly shot his sister many, many, many times. Then Scott, on which you say the law was changed, wasn't actually changed. We just explained why when you're looking at a medication order pretrial, it has different constitutional underpinnings than it does if you're looking at a medication order after the trial has already occurred.
Well, are you saying that a victim's rights will require an incompetent defendant to go to trial?
What it will require or do away with is the opportunity of the defendant to appeal the medication order, and that limits the defendant's rights.
You can always appeal it. There was an automatic appeal that was present with Scott, which we changed for pretrial medication.
Why wouldn't suppose there is a difference between equal force and no less vigorous? Why isn't that within the permissible discretion given to the legislature to provide a concise summary? Summary means you're not necessarily saying everything. And so there's got to be some leeway there. Anytime you're summarizing a law, if you're not using the exact language, you run a risk.
There's a difference between not saying everything and saying something that is not accurate. That's the difference, and that's why those words are in the question compared to the words in the amendment are so important. They actually mean different things. They cannot be said to be the same. So the question was inaccurate. Since Thompson, the ballot question may not contain misstatements. Things must be mentioned in accord with fact. The question was misleading, again, by instead of informing voters of the removal of language from our Constitution that kept and would have kept defendants' accused rights from being overridden by increasing victims' rights, doesn't tell the voters that any change has been made.
Thank you.
Counsel, I am concerned about the sequestration, which I think I made apparent in my one question when you were up before. Why is a second question not needed for that change?
Because every change in every component of the Marcy's Law Amendment tended to effectuate or carry out its essential purpose, which is to increase and strengthen victims' rights. And that's not our description of its overall purpose.
Why
that's
does that
theirs.
Increase a victim's rights that the sequestration order is changed?
Because the Marcy's Law Amendment provides victims with now an opportunity to be present in court. And so we're not, there's no debate that the Marcy's Law Amendment increased both the number and strength of victims' rights, but nothing in that amendment serves a purpose outside of doing just that. So the shift that happened in the language about sequestration was to provide victims with greater rights and increase the strength of the protection of those rights.
Why are their rights greater with the sequestration change?
So the Marcy's Law Amendment now provides victims with an opportunity to be present at all proceedings. And so that has increased and strengthened victims' rights.
Just because they took that out, are you telling me that a judge could never have a sequestration order for a victim?
No, and we know why not, because if a defendant's federal constitutional rights will be violated by having the defendant in court.
Federal constitutional rights, because clearly Wisconsin doesn't have the ability. I am persuaded opposing counsel's argument that Wisconsin Constitution, excuse me, I have been invaded by a frog over here. The Wisconsin Constitution has separate rights, and we've talked about that in many, many, many of our cases. I don't see how under the Wisconsin Constitution, which is what we're changing, mm-hmm. okay, the victims' rights were increased by the change in the sequestration order, when a judge could still order a victim to be sequestrated during the proceeding.
Well, it provides victims with a greater opportunity to be present in court than Article 1, Section 9M previously provided.
I'm thinking back to trial days, a lot like Justice Kroski at the end, and there were ways to balance sequestration with testimony such that you don't invade the rights of the defendant. And at least the judges that I knew pretty frequently found a way to have the victim testify early, have different provisions, maybe have them step out for a short period of time, not the entire time, provide them with other opportunities to listen in on the. There are ways to deal with it in a variety of circumstances, depending on the trial that is at issue and the rights and the issues at issue. I guess I'm not seeing this as a sea change in the sequestration law, because you always have to balance sequestration with fundamental rights.
Your Honor is correct. And in fact, the Marcy's Law Amendment essentially took a number of rights that have long existed in Chapter 950 for victims and has put them in the Constitution. And so you're correct that it's not a sea change, but of course this is a constitutional amendment, and so the ballot question reflected the shift that was happening. And I think that's really what we're talking, what matters here, because as Your Honor noted, how this is exactly going to play out in individual cases is a question for those individual cases. And what's critical here is that this question communicated the essential purpose, didn't present an entirely different question, and every provision, there is nothing in this amendment that doesn't serve the essential purpose of providing victims with greater state constitutional protections. And so what I'd like to conclude by talking about is what this Court did not hear. This Court did not hear any other analytical framework for judicial review that is consistent with this Court's prior case law and the constitutional discretion that courts must afford the legislature. That's because it doesn't exist. The Court did not hear any meaningful example of any way that this amendment has deprived defendants of state constitutional rights, and as I think Your Honors recognize, the one example cited of Green concerned this Court applying a U.S. Supreme Court balancing standard that involves consideration of interests of the public and the state. Though it is not how – may I briefly conclude?
Briefly.
Thank you. And though it is not, the question before the court is not how anybody else would have framed this question, this court did not hear any actual example of how the many different arguments that WJI has made throughout this litigation could actually have been presented in a concise question. And that's why we leave this question to the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your arguments this morning and joining us for the first day of oral argument. The court will adjourn and prepare for the second case this morning. We're adjourned.